Well, it's time for the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Thanks for joining us. We'll begin our program with a piece from the Spectrum News. It's entitled, Blind Runner is an Inspiration to Others, by Aaron Cotell Altman. Bill Smith puts one foot in front of the other and takes it one day at a time. He knew he wasn't going to let his blindness define him. My goal right now, I want to do the Boston Marathon, Smith said. While he's out on the trail, Bill has the help of his guide runners, Rebecca and Kevin, and his guide dog, Quidditch, his second guide dog from Guiding Eyes for the Blind. There's a lot of trust that goes into being with a guide runner, whereas Quiddy gives him something more to hold on to, said Rebecca Chapman, a guide runner. For most people, running is a way to stay in shape, but for Smith, it's much more. Sobriety for me right now is a wonderful thing. I thought I'd never ever get to this point, Smith said. After years of alcoholism, Bill has a new kind of addiction. It's the same thing with alcohol for myself. You get that high. You want to keep on going. For me, now is my running. The endorphins inside keep me high all day, Smith said. Smith says his path to recovery is a different type of marathon, and while he's working on himself, he's also helping others as a peer advocate at New Choices Recovery Center. I want to help people, he said. I'm going on 10 years in sobriety, and if I can stay sober, being blind and being an alcoholic, I'm pretty sure I can help somebody out there. Smith has a GoFundMe underway to raise thousands of dollars to achieve his dream of running the Boston Marathon. And now is a piece from the Harvard Business Review entitled Research, The Stigma Disabled People Face During Negotiations, by Terry R. Kutzberg and Mason Amory. Companies are increasingly strategizing on how to reduce all kinds of bias in the workplace, including those related to disabled people. Despite empirical evidence to the contrary, perceptions remain that disabled employees are less competent, less productive, require more supervision, and are more expensive and more dependent, which results in lower levels of both employment and promotion. However, disabilities are not a single entity, nor is the bias uniform across people or situations. For example, research suggests that disabilities categorized as invisible, including psychological and neurological, encounter more stigma than visible disabilities, such as amputations and paralysis. Although there has been a growing awareness and conscious effort to destigmatize mental health disabilities in recent years, tremendous bias still exists with consequences for employment, income, and levels of stress. In addition, research suggests that disabled women face even harsher penalties. While disability studies often focus on bias at the level of employment or promotion decisions, the lived experiences of disabled people also involve biases on the job. One context in which this can unfold is in professional negotiations. The prototypical image of a successful negotiator is someone who is competent, confident, and in control, characteristics that are not always readily applied to disabled people. Are disabled people more stigmatized in an intense job task, such as potentially contentious price-based negotiations? If so, is this stigma more pronounced for women and/or those with an invisible disability? To answer these questions, in partnership with the Rutgers Center for Women in Business, we had more than 2,000 people complete an online experiment. Participants were first provided with background information about a fictitious company they supposedly worked for and about a specific employee named Alex. an image of Alex was provided, and about half of our participants saw an image of a man, while the other half saw one of a woman. Participants were told that they would read a partial transcript of a negotiation and then be asked to provide their opinion about Alex, described as a colleague who had been on the job for about a year and was being asked to lead an important negotiation for the first time about the potential acquisition of a manufacturing plant. Alex was said to be a little nervous, but felt ready for this challenge. The transcript showed Alex asking for a break before the negotiation even started. The experiment varied the presentation of Alex with either no disability, a visible disability seated in a wheelchair which was described as due to a spinal cord injury, an invisible disability described as episodic epilepsy, an invisible disability described as bipolar disorder. In the three disability versions, Alex also requested that the negotiation occur over Zoom to accommodate the disability. The first offer made by Alex in the negotiation was also varied. In some instances, Alex offered honest information about the valuation of the property. In other instances, they misrepresented the valuation to potentially get a better deal, a condition we set up so that we could understand whether a disabled negotiator, of either gender, would be penalized further for this tactic. After reading the transcript of the negotiation and learning of its successful outcome, participants were asked to rate Alex on a series of items related to integrity, which included trustworthiness, warmth, confidence, morality, negotiation ethics, and perspective taking, and negotiation competence. Participants were also asked for their overall impressions of Alex. The key question in this study was how negotiators with specific disabilities might be evaluated differently compared to an employee with no disability, a different disability, or gender. Indeed, differences arose. Somewhat surprisingly, participants who saw Alex as male and seated in a wheelchair rated him as having more integrity and more negotiation competence than any of the other versions. This character was perceived to be more warm, likable, and competent than others, results that contrast with previous research about disability perception, which has shown that while disabled people are often considered to be warmer and more likable, they may be considered less competent than others. Interestingly, this effect disappeared when Alex was a woman, where the wheelchair did not seem to inspire the same bump in positive perceptions. It's possible that the stereotype of a man in a wheelchair as strong and able to overcome obstacles was activated for participants. We saw comments describing the male Alex as conscientious, capable, effective, and competent. By contrast, when Alex was a woman in a wheelchair, the comments described her as nervous, soft, and in over her head. Another gender difference emerged when examining reactions to the version of Alex who described living with bipolar disorder. While the man with bipolar disorder was perceived as having less integrity, the woman with bipolar disorder was perceived as not only lower in integrity, but also less competent. Neither the male nor female version of Alex with epilepsy was perceived as having an integrity deficit, indicating a stronger reaction to a mental health disability than to another invisible disability. Indeed, we found that gender stereotypes may be influencing perceptions of employee capability, even when their actual behaviors are identical. When the Alex character did not employ any negotiation tactic at all, but instead chose to present honest information about the valuation of the property, both the man and the woman with bipolar disorder were seen as having less integrity and lower competence in negotiation than a person engaging in the same behaviors but with a different disability. When Alex was a man and used strategic misrepresentation about the property's value, participants seem to have been reassured that he was up to the task. Ratings of integrity rose, while they were, relatively speaking, even lower for the woman. A woman with a mental health disability seems to be perceived as a greater risk on some level. Participants described her as awkward, odd, and stupid, with one person going so far as to say that they would be wary of her. Even a successful negotiation outcome didn't reassure our participants of her value as a negotiator. Further gender bias appeared in the responses. Many of the negative comments about the woman character with an invisible disability seemed harsh and gender-specific, such as, "She's dumb, obviously poorly trained, and has no idea what she's doing," or, "This woman is horrible at the opening bid. Let's see where this train wreck goes," or, "That's the bimbo's initial offer? Give me a break. How did she get this job?" There were no comparable comments about the same character engaging in the same behaviors when Alex was a man. Overall, these results speak to the extra burden of discrimination faced by those with mental health disabilities, especially for women who seem to face the double bind of the intersection of stigmatized categories. Research into the bias faced by those with mental health disabilities is nascent but growing, and companies are increasingly attuned to supporting the inclusion of all individuals. Some studies have begun to explore ways to lessen this bias, such as through specific, heartfelt words of inclusion in company policy statements, which may improve the hiring process for those with mental health disabilities specifically. Even when disabled employees demonstrate the same skills and behaviors as their non-disabled peers, they may still be subjected to biased judgments of their performance across job categories and tasks. For managers, the key takeaway is not to acknowledge what they likely already know, that bias exists and lurks in the workplace, but to confront it head-on to avoid missing out on the value that disabled employees of all genders bring to the table. In practical terms, this means, number one, reinforcing learning opportunities beyond one-off anti-bias sessions. While broad diversity trainings may be informative for all employees, research suggests they don't seem to change behavior. More effective efforts include a combination of clear leadership buy-in and qualified external trainers who create space for employees to learn, opportunities to engage in perspective taking, and a pathway for employees to track their progress over time. Number two, improving performance evaluation systems to reduce bias. Classic work on management objectives has long endorsed goal setting as a mechanism for creating transparency and equity in evaluation processes. Establishing clear targets as standards for the end products can help reduce bias across contexts. While traditional and often biased performance appraisal systems look backward, this approach shifts to a forward-looking planning process in which both managers and employees participate in and agree on objectives, which can include both outcomes and activities, and how to measure them. Tools that can help include creating effective rubrics before work has been performed, creating standardized templates for reviews and write-ups, having calibration sessions across managers, and using a management style that includes regular open-ended questions about how support can be offered. Number three, adopting disability inclusion along with sponsorship at all levels. Having disabled employees in leadership positions and in the leadership pipeline generates a sense of belonging and brings voice to critical policy decisions. Visibility in leadership matters for disability, as, for all other identities. Beyond the symbolic and the immediate effects of belonging, the ability to bring voice to decision-making roles encourages more inclusivity. In addition, formal programs around sponsorship, mentorship, and allyship can help companies navigate bias-prone situations so that each employee is represented and valued for their true capabilities. Mentors need to commit to exposing protégés to high-impact projects, increasing their visibility, and lending their own names to promote a positive reception of the work and the person. Number 4, conducting regular inventories of workplace practices. To ensure that inclusion efforts are sustainable and frequently improved upon, managers need to know where the pain points are and what might help resolve them, especially for issues that might otherwise fly under the radar, such as bias against a mental health disability or the intersection of multiple stigmatized identities. Resources are available for gathering this type of information, such as Disability Inclusion Blueprint, a toolkit for companies to curate questions for an internal audit, or suggestions for tracking the metrics relevant to success, selection, retention, promotion, pay, representation, etc. Additionally, employee resource groups can be a valuable source of not only support, but also information about the experiences of employees. These actions are a good starting point to prevent underestimating the contributions of disabled people and to protect companies from the legal and reputational risks associated with bias. Companies that opt to lose out on this talent pool do so at their own risk, foregoing the chance to improve their collaborative culture, lower absenteeism and attrition rates, create better relationships with stakeholders, and enhance their external reputation. This next article comes from The Standard. The title? Blind Photographer Captures Mouth and Feet Artists to Challenge Stereotypes. Ian Trahern was born with a condition that causes both blindness and deafness. By Aisling Grace. A blind photographer who captured artists with disabilities that paint using their mouths and feet has said he hopes to challenge stereotypical views on disability. Ian Trahern, 46, known as the Blind Photographer, was born with RP type 2 Usher syndrome, a condition that causes both blindness and deafness, and sees a 5% pinhole of sight. He harnesses his disability to create his images, specializing in black and white photography that uses light and dark to capture his subjects. The series of photographs called Shadows and Substance, The Mouth and Foot Painting Artists Through the Blind Photographer's Lens, shows artists in their studios using their hands or feet to paint their artworks. Mr. Trahern told the PA news agency it was great to photograph the artists from the UK's Mouth and Foot Painting Artists MFPA collective, and that he recognized commonalities between them. It was like having a silent understanding that we all had disabilities and we are dealing with big obstacles. But I think having that creative trait, we're kind of persistent in finding solutions, he said. That was something that I recognized amongst the five artists. They all have quite different personalities, but the one thing they all seemed to have was determination, persistence, and the love for art. He said he has learned to overcome challenges and uses a memory map to help him take photographs. As a photographer with limited eyesight, I just learned how to work around the challenges and the obstacles and find my own solutions to take the portraits, he said. That's generally how I work, whether I'm photographing or outdoors, is trying to build a memory map of points of the environment to help me build a picture so I can navigate and work around the artist. At the same time, I've got an incredible level of curiosity, so I get really passionate and excited about finding nooks and crannies. So I'm always pushing the boundaries of finding new angles to showcase people a bit differently, rather than just a generic portrait. Artist Rob Trent, 66, was born with arthrogryposis and typically paints landscapes and seascapes using his mouth. He was photographed by Mr. Trehearne for the series and told PA, "I thought it was incredible. It was really cool to see how we both use our disability to shape what we do. It doesn't define us, but it helps us create something from a different angle and perspective." Mr. Trent, a member of MFPA, added, "It's really great to be part of the community. We've all got different styles. We share ideas with each other, and we meet up when we can. It's really great to feel part of something like that." Mr. Trehearne says he hoped to challenge stereotypes with the series. "When I was growing up, imagery of people with disabilities weren't particularly positive, and that's something that I incorporate with my work to show a better representation and show the misconceptions as well," he said. "It was about changing stereotypical views of disability, capturing how the mouth and foot painting artists in their living and showing what ability they do have and how they're able to create in the way that they do." The photography series has been released by the MFPA, preceding a physical exhibition in 2025. Now here's a news release from the World Health Organization. WHO/Europe launches first ever technical advisory group on disability and health. World Health Organization Europe has launched a new technical advisory group, TAG, on disability and health. This is the first ever TAG on disability and will inform WHO's actions as it works with countries to build disability-inclusive health systems across the WHO European region. Officially launched at a technical meeting on 13 November 2024, the new TAG will be specifically tasked with advising on the implementation of the WHO European Framework for Action to achieve the highest standard of health for persons with disabilities, 2022 to 2030. Unanimously adopted at the 72nd session of the WHO Regional Committee for Europe in 2022. The launch of this new advisory group marks an important milestone in our work promoting the health and rights of people living with disabilities across the region, and we are, in fact, quite overdue when it comes to making concrete progress, explains Shirin Kiani, Technical Officer for Disability, Assistive Technology, and Rehabilitation and Ear-Eye Care at WHO Europe. "The collective knowledge and experience of the TAG will prove invaluable for developing proposals on the strategies and actions that governments, organizations representing persons with disabilities, and other stakeholders can take together to strengthen disability-inclusive health systems," she added. Gathering expertise. Members of the TAG include appointees from 23 countries across the European region who will work as part of the group for the next 2 years. They represent a broad range of disciplines relevant to disability and health, from statistics, inclusive policy and rights advocacy, to lived experience with disability, habilitation, rehabilitation, and social inclusion. These members serve in their personal capacities as academics and researchers, as well as bringing expertise from healthcare bodies, national public health institutes, and civil society organizations. Vugar Mamadov is one of the TAG co-chairs and also works as deputy chairman of the board for the State Disability Agency in Azerbaijan. He outlined what he sees as the role of the TAG. Many persons with disabilities in our region have unmet healthcare needs, so there is an urgency to develop policies and actions to address this. The TAG is determined to achieve the highest standard of health for persons with disabilities by advising WHO on the most effective, innovative, and evidence-based approaches available. At the core of the TAG's mandate is providing advice to WHO Europe on effective and innovative approaches to promote the health of persons with disabilities and how these might be replicated in the design, implementation, and evaluation of disability strategies within healthcare systems across the region. As part of their work, they will help evaluate programs, initiatives, and evidence, share practical experience from across countries on best practice, and advise on the investments health authorities need to make to improve health access and health outcomes to persons with disabilities. And now a piece from the Disability Scoop entitled "Disability Advocates Sound Alarm Over Possible Medicaid Cuts" by Michelle Diament. With Republicans set to assume control in Washington, disability advocates are warning that proposals are in the works to drastically reshape Medicaid and undermine the nation's system of home and community-based services. President-elect Donald Trump and his allies on Capitol Hill are reportedly looking to squeeze money from Medicaid and other safety net programs as they hunt for ways to offset the cost of extending tax cuts that were passed during his first term in office. The moves are setting off alarm bells for disability advocates who have spent years pleading for increased investment in the long-struggling Medicaid Home and Community-Based Services program, which serves as the backbone of support for people with developmental disabilities in this country. "We are extremely worried about Medicaid right now," said Nicole Jorwick, chief of advocacy and campaigns at Caring Across Generations, an organization advocating for caregivers and people who rely on them. "We have already heard that Republican leadership is looking into ways to cut Medicaid, like they proposed in 2017 and again in the 2023 debt ceiling fight, with either draconian work requirements or block granting. Either would put at risk the whole home and community-based services infrastructure. Traditionally, the federal government has provided matching grants to states to help pay for the cost of care for anyone eligible for Medicaid, no matter how expensive. However, during his first term, Trump and Republicans in Congress repeatedly pushed to transform Medicaid into a per capita cap or block grant system. Under those models, the federal government would instead provide a fixed amount of money to states each year for the program. Such a change would put pressure on states to limit spending and jeopardize funding for disability services," advocates say. "If Congress were to block grant the Medicaid program, it would eliminate the minimum standards, leaving all decisions to states on eligibility criteria and scope and duration of services," says Katie Neese, CEO of the ARC of the United States. "Such changes could force impossible choices. Would states decide to finance health and developmental services for children with disabilities, or would they only finance nursing home care for older adults? Would states pay for services that allow an adult to live at home, or would the adult be forced into a nursing home or hospital?" The worries about Medicaid come as the program's services for people with developmental disabilities are already under severe strain. Nearly 700,000 people across the country are on waiting lists for Medicaid waivers, which provide home and community-based services, according to the ARC. And even those with waivers aren't always able to access the services they need. A survey of hundreds of disability service providers late last year found that pervasive staffing shortages had prompted 77% of providers to say that they were refusing or no longer accepting referrals, and 44% to indicate that they had discontinued offerings. Over 60% reported that they were considering closing more programs or services. We are gearing up to defend Medicaid from any proposals that would cut services and supports, said Kim Muschino, Vice President of Public Policy at the Autism Society of America. People with disabilities are suffering with a collapsing service system. The federal government should be boosting funding for Medicaid to build the direct care workforce, not cutting it. Now here's a reminder that you're listening to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, John Curry. Next up is a piece from the Disability Scoop entitled, Malls Nationwide to Host Sensory-Friendly Santa, by Sean Heasley. As the holiday season kicks off, kids with autism and other disabilities will have a chance to visit with Santa Claus without all of the usual chaos during a series of special events across the country. So-called Santa Cares events will be held at numerous malls and other locations early next month. Santa and other staff will be trained to accommodate individuals with disabilities and their families. In addition, the lighting and music will be adjusted and there will be minimal wait times. To limit crowds, Santa Cares will be held when the surrounding shopping venues are closed, according to Cherry Hill Programs, which puts on the events in partnership with Autism Speaks. By actively creating opportunities for people of different abilities, and especially those with autism, Cherry Hill Programs offers an incredible example for other organizations seeking to promote inclusion and improve accessibility, said Jose Delaglio, Senior Director of Nationwide Community Engagement Operations at Autism Speaks. Inclusive environments foster a sense of belonging and acceptance within communities, serving as a foundation for personal growth, mutual respect, and societal progress. The sessions are free and open to people of all ages, but they do require reservations. There is a fee to purchase any photo package. Most Santa Cares events will take place December 8th. This next piece comes from Michigan Law, a publication of the University of Michigan School of Law. Former federal judge David S. Tatel reflects on his disability and the current state of the judiciary, by Annie Hagstrom. The Honorable David S. Tatel, who served for nearly 30 years on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, recently visited Michigan Law to discuss coming to terms with a disability as well as the current state of the judicial system. Judge Tatel's memoir, Vision, A Memoir of Blindness and Justice, Little Brown and Company, 2024, tells the story of his more than 50 years of blindness and how he has only recently learned to confront his disability. In the book, he also addresses falling public confidence in the U.S. Supreme Court's ability to serve as an impartial arbiter of justice. During his talk at the law school, which was moderated by Professor Nicholas Bagley and co-hosted by the Disability Rights Organization and the Jewish Law Students Association, he shared his story and his advice to law students soon to embark on legal careers in a country that feels divided. Deciding to conceal and reveal his blindness. Diagnosed at age 15 with retinitis pigmentosa, an incurable genetic retinal disease that causes gradual vision loss, Judge Tatel spent decades hiding his deteriorating eyesight. Even as he advanced as a civil rights lawyer in the late 1960s, he employed every cover he could to conceal his blindness from peers and colleagues. When Judge Tatel had no choice but to depend on a mobility cane, it became harder to hide his blindness. Still, he was determined to make it so that his disability would not hinder his career. Judge Tatel was the first director of the Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and later became the director of the National Lawyers Committee. During the Carter administration, he served as the director of the Office of Civil Rights and the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, where he worked to desegregate public schools across the country. Under his leadership, the office also began the enforcement programs for Title IX, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex in federally funded education programs, and Section 504, which laid the groundwork for the Americans with Disabilities Act by prohibiting discrimination in federally funded programs based on disability. In 1994, President Bill Clinton appointed him to serve on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, where he championed equal justice and decided landmark environmental and voting rights cases, among others. I would scrub press releases announcing new jobs if they had any mention of my blindness, he told the audience. I wanted to be known as a judge who happened to be blind, not as a blind judge. Things only began to change when I started writing my book. I had to first deal with my blindness before I could write about it. Judge Tatel and his wife, Edie, wrote the book together. The process forced them to think deeply about how he dealt with blindness, how they dealt with it together, and how it affected the Tatel family, including their 4 children, 8 grandchildren, and 1 great-grandchild. When I met Edie, I looked and functioned like a sighted person, said Judge Tatel. We both lived through the loss of eyesight and becoming blind. It affected our lives differently, but jointly. Another factor that shaped Judge Tatel's newfound acceptance of his blindness is the companionship he developed with his guide dog, a German shepherd named Vixen. Putting aside everything I knew about mobility and turning it over to a dog was one of the hardest things I've ever done, he said. But after a while, we gained confidence in each other, and I have a level of independence that I haven't had in 40 years. Vixen has liberated both Edie and me. Judicial restraint and the Supreme Court. Along with detailing his life and career, Judge Tatel's memoir discusses his concern about the U.S. Supreme Court's most recent term. The respect given to the court comes from the public's confidence that the judges act as judges, not politicians, he said. This court has too often abandoned the principles of judicial restraint. I'm deeply concerned about the separation of powers and the status and health of our democracy. Judge Tatel's perspective is influenced by both his distinguished legal career and his personal experiences during a time of national upheaval. In 1968, as the Vietnam War intensified and political unrest reached a boiling point, he and Edie welcomed their first child. The book chronicles how they could see smoke rising from riots outside their hospital window. I was determined to become the best civil rights lawyer I could because of that year, said Judge Tatel. I decided that was how I could best respond to the country's challenges. Speaking directly to the students, Tatel emphasized, I think the story is the same for all of you. In the coming years, lawyers will play a critical role in shaping the future of this country. Now is the time to hone your legal skills, pursue meaningful work, and help our country in as many ways as possible. The most important thing you can do is take advantage of what sets you apart. Demonstrate that even with a disability, you can be a great lawyer. This next article comes from the DAV.org. DAV, that's the Disabled American Veterans. DAV Benefits Advocate helps blind Vietnam veterans secure life-changing benefits. In 2016, Vietnam veteran Jose Flores' eyesight began to degrade, and the complications affected his ability to safely work in the food service industry. The illness forced him to retire, making his wife, Rebecca, both the family's sole source of income and primary caregiver for all of Jose's needs. My day starts with prepping Jose's meals, his drinks, and organizing his medications, especially his insulin, Rebecca said. If I don't do these things, Jose would not have a way to take his medications or have enough to eat and drink for the day while I'm at work. As a 22-year Navy retiree, Jose received a pension and used TRICARE for his health care services, but Rebecca needed to accompany him for all his medical appointments at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center in Bethesda, Maryland, a 30-minute drive from their home. She often had to miss work, which made it financially hard for the family. It was a struggle, and we are not proud of this, but we had to borrow money from our children to cover expenses like food and rent, Rebecca said. But we had no other choice, and it was important to learn the cause of Jose's blindness to see how we could manage it, and we discovered it was because of diabetic retinopathy. Diabetic retinopathy, which is a complication of diabetes that causes vision loss and blindness, is one of the most prevalent ocular problems among Vietnam veterans. Type 2 diabetes mellitus is a presumptive condition for veterans exposed to Agent Orange and other herbicides in Vietnam, and veterans with this condition may be eligible for disability compensation and health care through the Department of Veterans Affairs. However, Jose had never filed for disability compensation or enrolled in VA healthcare. When I retired in 1986, there was no transition assistance program in place, so I never knew I qualified for veteran benefits, Jose said. It was not until a friend of ours told us I should be eligible for veterans benefits because of my service in Vietnam. Several months later, while at another medical appointment, the Floreses relayed their frustrations with their experiences trying to navigate veterans' benefits to another recently retired veteran. That veteran empathized with their experience and not only told them where to get help, but also walked them over to the DAV office at Walter Reed, where they first met Danny Soto. Soto, a DAV benefits advocate, was very familiar with both military retirement and veterans benefits. They were both distraught, so I sat them down and listened to their story, Soto said. After hearing them out, I reassured them their claims had merit, and we sat down together and began the process of filing for VA disability compensation. The couple had gotten married years after Jose retired, so Rebecca knew little about Jose's time in the Navy. However, that began to change once Soto pulled Jose's military records, which revealed that he had been involved in fighting during the 1968 Tet Offensive. He had also taken part in a rescue operation that evacuated 276 American and foreign national refugees from Beirut in June 1976. Mr. Flores's military service was not only honorable, but it was heroic, said Soto. It is unfortunate that he and his family were unaware of the benefits that he had rightfully earned through his service and sacrifice. I knew that based on his current health and diagnosed conditions, that we could get him access to the full spectrum of VA benefits available to him and his family. After the initial filing, it took several months before the Floreses were to hear about a decision from the VA. All of a sudden, one day, a significant amount of money hit our bank account, so I called Mr. Soto to see if everything was okay, Rebecca said. Mr. Soto looked it up and informed us that the VA made its decision and that the money was our retroactive payment. Jose and I were in disbelief and just started to cry. We had struggled financially for so long, and with his VA benefits, we have been able to pay off our debts and become financially independent again. Besides VA disability compensation, Soto has helped the couple enroll in VA healthcare, which has specialized rehabilitation services for blindness and low vision that are not available under TRICARE. He also introduced the couple to DAV Caregivers Support, which provides tailored assistance and resources to caregivers like Rebecca to to ensure that they have the help to care for themselves and their loved ones. Mr. Soto has been an absolute godsend to us, Rebecca said. Thanks to his assistance, we not only have the help we needed, but also have the ability for Jose to go visit family in the Philippines for the first time in over 50 years. We hear this story far too often about veterans and their families not knowing if they qualify for benefits or how to start the process, said DAV National Service Director Jim Marzalek. Our benefits advocates are experts in their field who provide first-class service. They will ensure that our veterans and families are connected to not only all VA benefits available to them, but other programs like DAV Caregiver Support that has a positive impact on their lives as well. If you are a veteran and need assistance with applying for VA health care or disability compensation, please contact your nearest DAV service office by visiting benefitsquestions.org. Next up is an article from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation entitled, Books with Disabled Characters Show Children with Disability That They're Part of the World, Too, by Ashley Michael. The first time I read about a disabled character was in the Babysitter's Club series when I was 8 years old. One character I related to was Stacy McGill, who had diabetes. Even though Stacy and I didn't share the same disability, aspects of her life were familiar and relatable to me. Daily medication, doctor's visits, hospital visits as both an outpatient and inpatient, and the desire to not always have to worry about all that. Stacy was a comfort. Here was a girl who had disabilities and health issues like I did, and she was out there being a teenager at the same time, trying to fit in and navigate a world that saw her differently because of her disability. This was the first positive portrayal of disability I encountered in my reading. But like many people who grew up in the 1990s and 2000s, it would be many years before I read another positive portrayal of disability. Disability representation allows millions of people to feel seen. About 5.5 million people in Australia have a disability, but I have rarely seen people with disability represented in books, let alone in a positive light. As a reader and book reviewer, I also feel as though this cohort is being left behind in the reading that shapes children. Before reading about Stacy in the Babysitter's Club series as a child, I had to find other characters to relate to, such as characters who shared similar interests as me, who were good at the subjects I was good at, or who simply looked like me. I related to Liz in Teen Power Inc. because we looked alike, and Josephine from Looking for Ali Brandi because we were both good at English. But although these characters reflected elements of me, they didn't allow me to properly feel seen in what I read. When children can see themselves in the formative stories and books that shape their identities throughout childhood, it can have a big impact on them and on who they are and who they could be as an adult. Studies show that reading can create empathy, so books also help non-disabled people understand our world. This is important so future policymakers can know that people with disability are an active part of society and not just sitting on the sidelines waiting for someone to act for us. From villains to heroes. In the past, disability has had negative portrayals in books where a physical disability indicated the character was a villain. Think of Captain Hook in Peter Pan, Roald Dahl's Grand High Witch or Voldemort from Harry Potter. The way these characters look is seen as a marker of evil because no good character looks like them. Disability has also been portrayed as something to be healed or pitied, like Clara in the book Heidi, whose illness is healed by fresh mountain air and goat's milk. Disabled children never used to be the heroes of books, but today I'm pleased to see that this is changing, albeit slowly. Representation of hidden disabilities is important, too. Although there's now more representation of physical disabilities, invisible disabilities have been largely ignored, despite being more common than physical disabilities. These include common disabilities like autism, ADHD, and chronic fatigue syndrome, as well as less common disabilities like neurofibromatosis and Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. In recent years, Australian literature has seen a slow and steady change in this area as well, with a fantastic stream of books that have great disability representation. It's an area that I have fallen in love with because I'm seeing myself being part of the world. And because I review children's books and volunteer for the Children's Book Council of Australia, CBCA, children's books have an important place in my life. They have created a sense of community and connection for me when it comes to disability representation. Reading about the autistic protagonist in Pause by Kate Foster and Social Cue by Kay Kerr led me to investigate whether I myself was autistic, leading to my eventual diagnosis this year. Sophie Beer's Thunderhead and Pip Harry's Augustin Jones captured my experience of brain tumors, neurofibromatosis, and MRIs in ways I had never imagined could ever happen. I was seen, and because of these books, many children who have these same experiences of disability will be seen too. The power of these positive representations of disability goes beyond an individual level. They not only help children see themselves in more stories, like I did when I was 8, but they also show non-disabled people that we exist and that our experiences are valid, and that we are a valuable part of the world and we're not going anywhere. And now, a piece from Spectrum News entitled, AI is Helping People with Blindness Navigate the World Around Them, by Jas Kang, San Diego. He had issues with his vision for quite some time, but 5 years ago, Dr. Ron Peterson lost most of his eyesight due to continued complications of glaucoma. I see very, very little. I have the faintest of vision. I guess you might say about 5%, Dr. Peterson said, and that threw me for a loop. It happened rather suddenly, and I was very depressed for the better part of a year. After losing most of his eyesight, Dr. Peterson, who has a background in engineering, began researching how AI can assist people with blindness. Technology for the blind, especially with the evolution and the advance of artificial intelligence, has been very, very helpful to the blind, he said. As smartphones and technology have continued to evolve, AI is being used as a tool for those with vision impairment. An app called Be My Eyes has a feature called Be My AI, which allows users to take pictures of their surroundings, and the app will explain in detail what's in front of them. With new technology coming out at a rapid pace, Dr. Peterson teaches a class called Get Smart with AI at the Braille Institute in San Diego with his friend Nikki Warren, who also suffers from blindness. Warren can use a laptop with a screen reader that tells her exactly what is on the monitor. Warren understands how necessary it is to have access to quality programs. On the day-to-day basis, I can't function without technology, Warren says. It's very, very important that we teach others about what resources are available to them. According to the CDC, there are approximately 6 million people in the country suffering from vision loss, and 1 million people who are completely blind. Those numbers could increase in the coming years. It's projected to be 8 million in a couple of years, but that's nationwide, said Salvador Perez Quintana, who is the access technology specialist with the Braille Institute in Laguna Hills. So it's actually something that's going to grow tremendously as the population ages. So we're going to need a lot of resources. As AI continues to evolve in this space, Dr. Peterson believes things will be a lot different in the near future for people who suffer from blindness. Advanced apps or devices that you can wear, I think, could replace the white cane and could replace the guide dog, Dr. Peterson said. That's how far I think things are going to go in the next few years with artificial intelligence. And that will conclude our program for this time. Thanks for joining us for the Disability News Program. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. And keep in mind, you can take Sun Sounds with you. With the Sun Sounds of Arizona app for both Apple and Android phones, you can get our stream or you can choose programs on demand. You also can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device.